Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you so much for joining us on the program today. We come your way every Sunday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m., and we stream live at richarddugan.com. And you can get the programs on the radio shows page, so we encourage you to go there, check it out, and see what we have to offer. See what our guests have to offer. It's not so much what I have, but what they have. And they've got a lot of good information, and we certainly hope that you will avail yourselves of that information. RichardDugan.com, the radio shows page, also available. We'll have the portal, if you will, to the websites of our guests as well. So very exciting to be with you. And just as a point of, I'm just going to mention this just because I think it's relevant to maybe what we're talking about as well today. This program is the first program that I've had to been able to do since a major fire that swept through the Santa Barbara area during July of 2017. And to say the very least, it's 11 years that we've lived in the Santa Barbara area. We've been through 9 fires, actually 10. I had to recalculate, maybe even more. And this is the first one where we had to leave. We had to be evacuated. And it is not an experience that I would necessarily soon repeat, although there were some aspects of it that were quite interesting. And at the same time, it's like, okay, got to keep your head, and you've got to do this and that and the other thing just to, first of all, to get out of the line of fire, no pun intended. Make sure that if you have animals, that they're all safe, that you've gathered up those things that you want to preserve just in case the fire reaches your structure. And then get the heck out of the way and then stay out of the way as long as is necessary. And I've learned how to pack and unpack and load and unload the car over and over and over again. And finally, we were able to go back home, and that was certainly a big, big relief. So maybe we might even find some solutions, some support, some help from our guest today, who is joining us for the second time, and very grateful that she is. And Acharya Shunya is my guest. Thank you so much for coming back on the program today.
My pleasure, Richard.
This is a time for everyone there are those who would say that here in the United States, we have been struggling for the last 2.5-3 years with a lot of stress and strain, especially with, I don't know how our political structure has developed to this level. But there was a point at which, once the election was over, maybe we could all collectively sort of take a breath, take a pause and relax and just, okay, it's over finally, and now we can wait for the January 21st or 20th and blah, blah, blah. And there was no pause. There hasn't been a pause for nearly 3 years. And that starts to wear on people. And it's not just that. I mean, we have natural disasters, as I was mentioning. Of course, the fire wasn't a natural disaster. Unfortunately, it was man-caused. But we do have them, earthquakes, and we have had flash floods in different areas and hurricanes. And then we have other man-made disasters of conflict that are going on that really stress people out. And you have done a lot of work in this area dealing with the ancient wisdom, the ancient Eastern wisdom of Ayurveda for mental health and lasting well-being. And some of us, including myself, I'm working on all of this myself. Sometimes we really struggle on a mental health, a psychological level with some of this stuff. And, you know, we want it to go away. It's not going away. And we've never really developed what some people call the coping mechanisms. Talk to us as we start our program here about the ancient Eastern wisdom of Ayurveda and how it can assist us on an individual, let alone a community basis, to, I don't know, prepare for these things, or if we're in the midst of them, how we can better cope with them as we're going through them. And then even in the aftermath, once everything is settled, the dust has settled, you know, we're still dealing with, you know, some people say that, oh, you have post-traumatic stress disorder from some of these things. Talk to us a little bit about the wonderful influences of Ayurveda.
Richard, first I wanted to thank you for beginning the show with such candid acknowledgement of your own vulnerability and how challenging it must have been to pack and unpack and know that this was, you know, you're a victim of cosmic circumstances and other people's irresponsibility because it was a man-made fire, but wow to you. And the fact that you would then take your own suffering and connect it to a larger collective suffering. And the cause of the suffering may be an outer fire or an inner fire of emotions or ego or hatred, but it's all still, it devours our essence and, you know, pretty much exhausts us. So a great opening and, you know, and thank you for asking that, what can Ayurveda offer? Because Eastern wisdom has always wanted to look at the human being, in fact, all living creatures, as an integrated collective entity with the body, the mind, and the spirit, and even godhood, all combined in one. Even God is not something or someone remote, but an inexhaustible, boundless, formless, divine source presence. And the mind and the body and the emotions, they all affect each other. So first, I just want to acknowledge that I'm excited for the beginning. And good beginnings lead to good discussions. What do you think?
Well, absolutely. It is one of those things that, as I say, it tries the soul. There's no question about it. It tests the soul, our spirit, our stamina within. But I've also been learning over the last, several years of doing this radio program, of which we've been doing for, 10 years plus. And the one thing that has always seemed to come out is it doesn't matter what's going on the outside. It is truly what is going on the inside. It is the inner life that is of paramount importance. If it were possible to do, ignore what's going on. Ignore what your eyes and your ears and your senses are telling you. Stay focused on yourself and who you are. And again, this is a small S, not a big S, because that's where the wisdom is. That's where the strength is. That's where the real support is. And also our connectivity, if you will. You know, you talk about the internet, and mostly it's wires. And of course, we hear about Wi-Fi, too. But we have our own. And it's that inner life and that intuition, too.
Precisely. That inner life is very much a focus in Ayurveda, so that the outer life and the outer being can play and enjoy and cope with any difficult situations that come forward. And for the sake of our listeners, I would just like to review that Ayurveda is a 5,000-year-old system of health and healing from India. And interestingly, it never died or went out of currency. It remained active, not only in India, but throughout Southeast Asia, due to traveling Buddhist monks who took Ayurveda all over Southeast Asia up to Japan on foot. And now in the recent last four decades, Ayurveda has made a global presence felt because more and more people are turning to its holistic and profoundly deep and spiritually attuned wisdom. And I have been asked by Richard to shed light on some of the deeper teachings in Ayurveda that go beyond the body into the mind and into the realm of the inner being. And Richard, I wanted to just start with saying that one of the ways Ayurveda asks us to look at our own mind is more objectively. The mind is a subjective field, but we, the spirit and the observer, the witness, can actually instead of subjectively inquiring into the subjective field, objectively inquire into it. It's a self-discovery process, an inner exploration process. It's an investigation process. And in that course of investigation, we shall find, according to Ayurveda, that the mind is really made up of thoughts. And these thoughts are all woven with three common qualities, and I would just take a minute to enumerate them. There is the quality of agitation, stimulation, excitation, and this is known as rajas, or the agitating quality. And this is what gets us curious or concerned or anxious or worried or excited. Then there is the quality of dullness, which causes sleepiness, heaviness, indifference, apathy, and in extreme cases, even depression, if this quality takes over the mind. Thankfully, there is another redeeming and final quality called sattva, which is the balancing quality, the observer quality, the more neutral quality, the non-passionate but ethical quality, the quality of inner peace, calmness in spite of outer fires. And you might have experienced all three qualities raging through your mind from agitation, which is rajas, to self-pity, which is tamas, T-A-M-A-S, to ultimately coming to a new space around, wow, even this difficulty is such a gift because I'm being able to explore my own inner resilience, my inner powers, and my inner ability to cope, which surprises me. And in fact, I become a support through my radio show and other such endeavors, or my sheer presence in my family and community as a pillar and as a rock. So we surprise ourselves by this third quality, sattva, though some of us remain asleep to it. So we mostly vacillate from agitation to self-pity, from excited doing to self-pitying non-doing. And what Ayurveda invites us in each and every opportunity is to then meditate, to contemplate, and to expect greater inner guidance. And Ayurveda says the mind is your friend, just learn to talk to it in a different way. And with this, I introduce the capacity of the Eastern sages to look at the mind beyond the brain and the cells and the neurons, at its quality and the quality of consciousness we choose to embody. Is that a good opening for our listeners, Richard? Do you think this will excite them?
I think it very much will. I think it has. Of course, this is your second journey down our little road, as it were, to share with our folks, our listeners, and so forth. You actually have a book. Can you talk a little bit about that work that you put out not too long ago?
Oh, absolutely. I'm so happy that in February of this year, I released the Ayurveda Lifestyle Wisdom that teaches us an art of living that balances our body and mind, of course, and, gives joy to our spirit on an everyday basis, a 24-hour period and a seasonal cycle. And Richard, I'm happy to tell you that it's the number one bestseller in Ayurveda. And it's doing really well. And thank you for asking.
Well, congratulations. I myself have been working on a book for 16 years, and it's not that big, but it's just I made the promise at the beginning of 2017 that I was going to finish it, among other promises I made. And some of them I've actually so far kept, and so I still have a little time to start finishing it up and so forth. But then you have all these wonderful little distractions, like a fire and all those kinds of things. And I have to tell you that in light of that experience, I actually was slightly disappointed that we were allowed to go home, because I was really enjoying staying with some friends of ours. Actually, they've become close friends since we stayed with them. I was like, oh boy, this is great. I would just really like to just stay here for a while longer, because we were out of the normal routine, which isn't a terrible thing, but yet what was really nice was there were certain things I did not have to deal with, during that period of time. And I really wanted to go on, even if it was just a couple of days more. And sometimes we need to give ourselves that, don't we? We need to step out of our routine My wife and I actually, in December of 2016, between Christmas and New Year's, took our first vacation in 10 years. And we drove up to Yosemite in Nevada City, California, and even visited a community called Ananda Village north of Nevada City. And I told my wife before we left, I says, and there are no timetables. Yes, we have reservations at these different places, but we are going to give ourselves so much time that we are not going to be rushing, and we never did. And that made all the difference. So talk to us about, though the inner life is extremely important, if the body doesn't have what we need to keep moving, you know, the inner life is great, but if you haven't taken care of the outer, you know, the body and that type of thing, you know, that's a downside as well. So talk to us about taking a little retreat and time out.
You know, I really love the idea of gifting our being time. And I think time is of essence in taking care of the physical body, because the physical body does experience wear and tear through time. And in fact, if we try to speed it up too much, so the limbs are moving and, you know, all kinds of things are being expected of the physical body, and it doesn't get enough rest, both during the daytime where it has periods of doing nothing, and you know, sleeping by 10 p.m., waking up early in the morning, having a good night's sleep, all of this can really undo the existential experience, I have to say that. And over my almost three decades of working with people with all sorts of physical, emotional, spiritual ailments and suffering, I can say that sometimes the spiritual community can quickly poo-poo the body and think that we can meditate our way, or we can, you know, transcend our way to a complete well-being. And we'll just, you know, skip over this physical, you know, 5 feet above, or just a little below 5 or above 5 feet, you know, structure that we live in. But that's not the case. And Ayurveda is here to remind us that the physical body is our vessel, and it is through this vessel that we interact and engage with the world and complete our, you know, material and spiritual goals, and actually embark on vacations or journeys of self-actualization and self-realization, Richard. So Ayurveda wanted to teach us an art of living, and this includes a concept of eating as per seasons. And in my book, I lay out, you know, actually, you know, a seasonal diet, and I lay out 6 seasons. So there are like periods of seasons in between the 4 main seasons also. So 6-season diet. So it's really wonderful and marvelous that, you know, nature was choosing to grow different foods and not grow certain foods in different seasons, not because it was whimsical, but because they are scientifically attuned to keep our body in balance. And I'm glad you prefaced my conversation with a vacation. I personally feel that leading this Ayurveda lifestyle has been a lifelong vacation for me, because it includes oiling the body, you know, growing flowers and then making teas of different flowers and herbs that can inexpensively grow in your backyard or your terrace. And, you know, just kind of indulging ourselves. And it's sometimes people come up to me and say, Shunya, is this medicine or is this like, you know, indulgence? And I laugh.
Well, and the thing, though, that we, I think in this country in particular, because I hear the stories of workers in other parts of the world who, in some instances, it's almost mandatory that you have to take time off. They won't let you work 52 weeks in a year, kind of thing. I don't know if it's France per se, but I think they it's like 4 weeks. You know, you're given 4 weeks of vacation and you must take them. You know, don't care what you do with them, but you can't stay here. You know, it's like you don't have to go home, but you can't stay here, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And whereas in this country, it's like, and I think I heard a statistic that said that the most people in this country don't take their vacations, not because they don't want to, but because they're afraid that if they do, that they will lose their job. And it's like, that's not helping that's not helping our soul to live in that kind of angst and fear, which is another element of our society in particular that we, you know, that we deal with in terms of, you know, we're not thriving. And that's really what and this is just my observation, and I ask you to elaborate on this. Ayurvedic and many of these Eastern teachings and the ancient wisdom teachings are promoting what I like to refer to as thriving and not just surviving.
Oh, you just said it. I mean, that's beautiful. And in fact, the words that were coming to me was that, do you want to, I guess that we have an invitation, and because we are so powerful, we can walk any path we want. And the question is, do we want to be stuck in survival consciousness, as you said, or do you want to move into thrival consciousness or abundance consciousness and play consciousness and God consciousness? So Ayurveda actually says that surviving, or, you know, making, and there are two kinds of survival. We need to make sure we have the material needs met. So that takes care of our biological survival. We have food, we have roof, we have clothes to wear. And then there is emotional survival, which also we need. We need to get our promotions on time and our peers to give us respect and our relationships to, you know, be worthy for us. And then, you know, so it's important. And we also need pleasure. So some of us get, you know, we appreciate our jobs because it helps us buy big houses with huge backyards and jacuzzis and special cars and, you know, things like that. So we do have a desire for survival and for pleasure. But there is another worthy goal that Ayurveda wants us to think about. And it's the goal called Dharma. And Dharma in simple English term can be called as, you know, alignment with a spiritual, greater spiritual reality, alignment with the greater spiritual universal call of, you know, oneness and fruitfulness and abundance. And so we're not here to be imprisoned by our survival needs, our biological, our material, our relational, or our pleasure needs. We are supposed to enjoy all of that, appreciate it, but remain in a state of freedom from it. And ultimately, we are asked to expect more from ourselves. And one of the dharma, one of this universal value is called swadharma, or the dharma to the self, the greater S, as you had mentioned in the earlier introduction to our show. So there is a dharma that you and I individually embody to our own higher self. And one of them is to remain authentic to who we are. One of them is to remain, alert and aware that we also deserve, you know, lighter moments, sun-filled days, vacations where there is no timetable, and an ability to say no to something, an ability to say yes to something heartfully, and not because we are coerced to, because society wants it. And, you know, in my clinic, charitable clinics that my graduates run, I noticed that from cancer to schizophrenia, it all began with somewhere us getting bound up and locked up and stressing out in that survival mode. And really, that is why the Eastern wisdom wants us to unzip and unlock whatever imprisonment we have self-imposed ourselves to, step out of it and reclaim our true nature, our true self, and choose dharma towards ourselves. Because when we are self-soothing, self-pleasuring in a positive sense, self-benefiting, self-growing beings, we become full and the cup floweth over. And it is only then that we can become dharma ambassadors and support the world. So somewhere, Richard, if you were not following your own swadharma, even if you didn't take up external vacation in a car, I'm sure during a given day you have many moments of vacation because of which you can continue on your path of this incredible radio series for years on end. Similarly, I have been on this path for the last 3 decades without a day break. And I'm not also somebody who takes many expensive, fancy vacation, but taking a vacation within the same hour while I work, I also rest and I give permission for myself to walk, to garden, to cook myself fresh food, to, you know, to take a luxurious bath. All of these are vacations. And Ayurveda gives me the permission to do it, and in fact encourages me and tells me that it's urgent that I look after myself, I fall in love with myself, and I take the time to demonstrate that love to myself.
And I just, it just so happens that I was fortunate enough 11 years ago or so to move to Santa Barbara, and I had been wanting to get to the ocean for the longest time, that I just felt this need to be near, and it really didn't matter whether it was the East Coast, the West Coast, although it's got to be more northern than even where we are today because it gets rather warm here. I'd had enough of the heat, basically. this is where we live now, and I can walk to the beach, walk to the water in 20 minutes from where I work now, where it would take me 20 days from Phoenix, which is where I used to live. So that is one of those mini vacations, if you will, those little respites that I get to go out, say, to the end of the wharf, if not down to the surf and so forth. So that's quite nice. But in addition to that, where we live above Santa Barbara in the hills, we are impacted by nature. We've had a bear up on the property where we live. I got some pictures of that. We've had a flock of, a couple of deer, a family of deer. We've had wild turkeys. We've had quail. There have been, maybe bobcats and that kind of thing as well, but, no danger to us at that in that respect. And then, of course, the incredible birds that we've had, blue jays and crows, and we've even had a seagull or two up that far. And I'm curious as to the Ayurvedic discussions, if you will, in regards to nature's role in our life, and even more specifically, nature as the teacher, nature as the example, even in our modern day 21st century technologically advanced lifestyle. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, I think it's a crux of Ayurveda's wisdom is nature as a teacher. And Richard, the ancient sages who gave us Ayurveda, for a long time it was a body of oral wisdom that was transmitted carefully from mentor to disciple. And some, 2,000 years ago, it got captured in texts that have survived time and they're available till date. So I really love that. They are available, and each page of those texts reminds us that we don't have to reinvent the wheel, and let's look at what nature is trying to tell us. So for an example of that is that nature goes to all this effort to turn on a great big switch of light in the morning, which is the sun, and then switches it off around sunset. And if you look at all of nature and organisms and beings in nature, so plants, animals, worms, tigers, giraffes, camels, everybody, they are up early in the morning with the rising sun. There is an excitement in the universe, and but for the human being who's trying to turn off the snooze button and get in that extra hour, a bulk of 99% of nature is waking up with the sun. And when the sunset starts coming around, there is some, but for a few exceptional creatures, the bulk of nature and its beings fall asleep. If not exactly at sunset, there is an introverted journey back inwards. There is more family time, quiet time. But what do? We've invented our bulbs and our internet and our technology. And we create our own virtual universes. We've created our own Las Vegas everywhere in our own homes. So we have lots of light and lots of artificial light. We've even created artificial sunlight when it should be moonlight time. And I have found over the years that all this has really disturbed sleep cycles. When sleep cycle is disturbed, digestion gets affected. And after a while, the mind cannot process, cannot recall, cannot do simple computation. And so sleep affects food, food, then sex gets affected, our seed gets affected, and then we have more and more birth disorders, genetic conditions. And probably it all began because the human being refused to go to bed. You know? And it's a simple thing, and I've argued for that, and I've tried to explain it, and I've tried to invite people back to, you know, rhythms of nature. And the chronobiological rhythms, two kinds are born, Richard, and I'll conclude with that. One rhythm is born when the Earth orbits on its own axis. So we have this change in the light, and we could probably connect with it. And we've had so many people improve their health simply by following the path of the sun across the sky in a 24-hour period. And the other rhythm is born because of the Earth orbiting around the sun, which takes roughly 12 months. And, you know, four seasons, four main seasons, and six subtle seasons total. And these seasonal changes get reflected in a change in lifestyle and food too. And most animals remember that, oh, winter is here, so I need to eat this food and not that food. Even plants know how much water to soak and how, when not to, you know, when not to eat what. If you overwater it or over-fertilize it, plants don't do well because they are programmed to work with the seasons. But as humans, the word is we forgot. And that's why we need an Eastern wisdom like Ayurveda. It's not even just medicine. It's not intervention, fix it, medicine. It's an evocative, thriving, thrival evoking invitational wisdom to consider Mother Nature as a teacher, a mothering teacher, and not live in defiance of her, but in submission to her. And we find that science is now corroborating more and more of these facts, that when we are exposed to sunlight, the serotonin increases. When we are exposed to darkness, melatonin increases, and the brain needs both of these cycles, not just one. It's beautiful.
You're the president of the California Association of Ayurvedic Medicine, and it's interesting to me to observe. I have not been a recipient, if you will, of any of a lot of these wonderful ancient modalities, if you will, as I like to call them. And yet I am a firm believer in them simply because my observation, especially, for example, with Chinese medicine, it's been around for 5,000 years, okay? Well, there's been no FDA, and the reason why it works is because they just know it works. There haven't been extensive research projects and double-blind studies. They just know it works, and I'm thinking that with the Ayurvedic medicine, it's the same thing. It's probably even older. Please enlighten us a little bit about this aspect of this particular modality we call Ayurvedic medicine.
Indeed, I would say that, something that goes back 5,000 years is uninterrupted, is practiced not only by India, but many Southeast Asian countries. And, you know, up to 60 to 70 to 80% people are using it and not dying in bulk. They don't need one narrow focus FDA to prove its legitimacy. This has been proved by time, by tradition, by word of mouth, by oral, embracing of that wisdom by cultures, communities, transnational, unquestionable benefits of Ayurveda. So something like this has tremendous appeal, and it works. And, you know, people like me who have been working with Ayurveda outside India, you know, we guess what kind of people approach us, the kind of people who have become disappointed by Western medicine or have reached a limit to how many drugs they can consume. They find there is no road anywhere. And then they come to my institution, to my classes, to the clinics run by my organization, and they hear a simple fact that, oh, your liver could turn around if you just start sleeping by 10 p.m. It's like, whoa, that's too simple. This couldn't be medicine. It's like, well, yes, and 5,000 years of people sleeping on time and improving their liver function and the liver profile, and your blood tests will prove it to you in a few months from now. So people do it, if nothing out of curiosity or maybe skepticism, where they want to prove us wrong. And then they find that their blood profile is changing because the body is a living organism that is tied to the rhythms and the chronobiological rhythms of nature. Is just not a separate entity. And then they get convinced. Now, what the you know, it's still out what FDA will want to do with Ayurveda in the long run. But associations like the California Association of Ayurvedic Medicine, the National Association of Ayurvedic Medicine, there are many such statewide and national chapters that are opening up everywhere. These are groups and groups of people in the United States, and then there are similar groupings in various countries of Europe and, you know, South America, South Africa, where these people are saying, we want Ayurveda to be now in the forefront because it's time to have people-centered medicine, and it's time to look at what these Eastern systems of medicine that have been around for so long and are so mature, and why are they so popular, and why are they growing at grassroots, and why do people, you know, spend their own private, wallet money on Eastern medicine? Why? And the answer is, it works.
Yeah, that's it. I, and a matter of fact, that was the an interesting experience we had on a program with my Vedic astrologer, David Hawthorne, and he got a phone call from a gentleman. I recognized the voice, and I knew from where this person came from philosophically, and he basically challenged my guest and asked him, well, how do you know that it works? To which David replied, well, you know, I've never been asked that question, but I just know it works. And yeah. that's an inner knowing. That's an inner, shall we say, confidence, if you will. And that's why this is also very important, because without these kinds of things, we're going to be going down a road that is going to be hard to come back from if we don't begin the process. Again, letting our listeners know, we're talking with Acharya Shunya, and she has a book. It's entitled Ayurvedic Lifestyle Wisdom, and you can pick that up. She has a website, acharyashunya.com. I beg your pardon. No, it is .com. That is correct, .com. And it is spelled acharyashunya.com. And we encourage you to go to her website and check that out. We're going to continue our fascinating and wonderfully enlightening conversation with Acharya here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan. Please stay tuned.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us here on the program. This is, I can't thank you enough for taking so much time to share with us about so many of these different things. You know, I started out the program, of course, talking about my experiences with my wife and our evacuation order that was placed on our area due to a fire in the Santa Barbara Hills. One of the elements of it was the challenges that we faced as a couple, as two people traveling together from one hotel to another. And in the early days, the first 3 days, we actually had our two dogs with us. And that was a challenge in and of itself because we weren't sure which hotels would allow us to stay. We'd actually found one that let us stay there for 3 days with the dogs, at which point we made the decision to actually go home. And then, of course, a few hours later, I raced up the hill and pulled everybody down again. And then we put the dogs in a place that was offering free boarding for animals who were of evacuees. So then it was just the two of us. But the struggle and the stresses that we faced, there were times when, you know, I was short with her and she was short with me, and we both had to stop and acknowledge, okay, look, we're both stressing. We, you know, we have to hold on to each other, you know, and we'll get through this, and it'll be over soon enough. And that's the other aspect of it too, is I couldn't believe, even though in the midst of it, it was like, my gosh, this is going on so long, 3 days, 4 days, we were out for 10 days. It was over in a sense before we knew it. Now it's like it was like a blur even the day or two after. And yet we managed to hold it together. But you talk about Ayurveda's timeless wisdom in regarding fostering and nurturing healthy relationships. Share, enlighten us, if you would.
Ayurveda likes to look at three sets of relationships. The first one is mostly a one-way relationship, and it's with material objects like our boat, our special, you know, shoes. And actually, sadly, even our pets come under this category because they don't talk back to us. And so it's mostly our runway love towards them. And, you know, we can question that category, but we should understand why we are putting pets and material objects in one category, because they make us feel good. And it's good to have these relationships. And Ayurveda says, go for it. Ayurveda doesn't ask us to be poor or be stuck in poverty consciousness or, you know, pretentious, spiritual, frugalness. It says you're a material being and you're here to enjoy material objects and to indulge and spoil yourself with them. Go for it. But at the same time, Ayurveda cautions that don't get obsessed with it, because in time, objects either break or die, or, you know, it's a one-way movement, and don't get obsessed by them and colored by them. The other type of relationship Ayurveda talks about is a two-way relationship, and it's between humans, and they could be both professional, collegial, or, you know, intimate. And in this relationship, Ayurveda says they are very important, so don't try and escape them. Don't try and live in a bubble and pretend that, you know, you're growing spiritually and you're becoming really emotionally healthy because you have an absence of these relationships. In fact, go out and seek those relationships, but have healthy, you know, take some time to figure out what are your values and what are your needs. And for these relationships to work, you know, there's 75% compromise. I mean, even you and I making this radio show effective, we are compromising, or we are meeting each other, or we are collaborating at some level to make it a win-win experience for both the host and the person who's being interviewed, and ultimately for the listener. Because if it was all about you or all about me, then we really ruin it for each other and for the listener. So for every relationship, a two-way relationship will thrive, there is some degree of sacrifice, and let's face it, and make it a willing one and a joyous one. But then Ayurveda wants us that 25% of the time, if it's a matter of your deepest core needs, identify them, and your core values, then there is no negotiation. Negotiations are off the table, and you must walk. And I think it's very empowering. And as a woman growing up, I found this wisdom so empowering. I meet many women, not only from my culture, but even America, and they're so disempowered. And I'm like, wow, you're 100% compromising. Where is you? Where are you negotiating, you know, for who you are? So that's really beautiful. And then finally, and the most fascinating aspect of it, which is, you know, that most of us remain asleep to a third and most vital relationship, which is with our own higher self, true self, authentic self, the inner being with a capital S. There is an invisible presence within us, besides the visible mind, ego, I am so-and-so, I am Acharya Shunya, I am from India, I promote Ayurveda and yoga and Vedanta and Vedic sciences. That's all that's the resume for the one you can identify, mm-hmm. who can speak for herself. But there is another invisible presence who words cannot describe, and only I can know her because she's self-revealing. And I can know her when I become quiet. And she remains, she's non-aging, she's undying, she's unthwarted by life experiences, and she's a witness, and she's there for me. And she's not even a she or a he, but I call her a she, just for convenience. But it's really my spirit. And, you know, this higher self is connected to the divine. And knowing this requires a spiritual journey, quiet time, contemplations in nature, and quietening down of the gossip of the world and other relationships. And this three-pronged invitation is something I offer my students and my disciples. And I find that it's wonderful and it's freeing that this was acknowledged by a system of medicine. And it says that once you have a relationship with your own self, your outer relationships begin thriving and become spontaneous and energizing. So that's what I would like to share with you, Richard.
You know, in what we're talking about here in relationships, I've even heard it said, too, that the number one, of course, relationship is that with self, with the higher self, and seeking the guidance and support and encouragement and so on and so forth, as you've just elucidated on. And I find that I mean, there was this great poem that I came across through some of my studies. And I believe the author's name was, I want to say Tiberius, something like that. Anyway, the gist of the poem was that the gods were concerned that man was seeking a way to elevate himself up to the status of God, in essence. And they thought, you know, okay, we need to hide this secret. We need to make sure that man does not find this, because obviously there's a certain level of threat there. And they began to discuss, well, where will we hide it? And they ran through a litany of places. We'll hide it in the depths of the ocean. No, he'll find a way to get down there. We'll hide it in the highest mountain. He'll climb it, and we'll hide it here, and we'll hide it there, and da-da-da-da-da. And finally, one of them said, I know where we'll hide it. We'll hide it in his heart. He'll never look there. Why is it that, and from the Ayurvedic perspective, why is it that man is so afraid of going inside?
Yeah, that's what I call the, you know, Ayurveda says that there is the spiritual truth, but along with that, there is the ignorance, and probably our human existence or our embodied existence is partly due to the spiritual cosmic naissance or ignorance. And it feels like if we go within, it's a death of the ego. What the little we know, even if it's terrible, abject, dismal littleness that we embody, we're attached to it. And it's bred from our own spiritual ignorance. And part of the awakening process in Ayurveda is awakening to the knowledge that we are more than just our biological body with its relations, with its family members, its race, its titles, and its property and its accumulation, and that we are spirit, and that actually all spirit in all beings is one, and that one spirit is God. So it's like and you know, it's interesting that I think it's a journey. I this is me speaking now, Richard. Mm-hmm. In my fifth decade in life, I feel that Earth is a classroom. And the trick is that you can keep playing to one set of rules, thinking that's the only reality. So the rules of making it big in society, making a name for ourselves, you know, winning a point in an argument. And we think, yeah, go for it. Doggy dog world. Every man for oneself. And yeah, that's right. And my race versus yours, and my religion or my guru versus yours. And that's one set of rules. And some people think, wow, I'm so ahead of others, you know, and they go to those special institutions to make sure everything is stacked up for them. But then the classroom.
Oh, my.
There's my dog playing by one set of rules.
Yes, and there's nature.
There's nature. But then the human being is that unique animal with a mind, with a choice, with an opportunity to look for another set of rules, the rules that unite us and take us beyond our own ego individuality into a greater united experience and transcendental experience. And at that time, all ill health subsides. And the ego and its dramas calm down, and what remains is the blissful self. And I do feel that this is a classroom. And occasionally we come across books, radio shows, people, teachers, whose voice, whose eyes, whose message, whose writings, they remind us of something familiar. And that unknown familiarity is really with our larger self.
Well, you also have a center up in the San Francisco area. Am I not correct?
That is correct.
And this is not, is this a place where, and again, I know that there's also online, there are also online study courses and so forth where people can study with you. But this is this a facility, a teaching facility as well?
That is right. Vedika Global, VEDIKAGlobal.org is the website. And I just thought I'll add it since you're talking about it. And Vedika Global is a beautiful not-for-profit where we are leading charitable medicine classes and, you know, trying to awaken people to their maximum potential using this ancient wisdom.
Mm-hmm. In the years that you have been doing this work and obviously very familiar with, and I'm sure still even still now learning in regards to the Ayurvedic medicine and the teachings, the wisdoms, these and so forth, what kinds of changes have you seen? Even, for example, I mean, I guess the best place to start is where you live, in the community in which you live. Have you noticed some significant changes that you can describe for us that can share with us how things are transforming? I don't want to necessarily say for the positive, but to where people are learning how to better thrive, I guess maybe that's the best way to put it, in their lives and sharing that with others as well, to where now it's families and even communities, to where this is starting to spread and people are really, they are beginning to understand that, you know, we don't have to suffer. We don't have to go through all of these things. There is another way.
Definitely. My small self, to begin with, my small self was very fortunate to be born in a family of teachers. So our family has been, promoting this Vedic knowledge and wisdom for many generations. So, but still my small self was small and I felt like I needed to work it and make it happen. And I took failures and victories personally. So but I can report to you, Richard, that my small self is now nestled and embraced by my higher self more and more every day, and I find more enduring peace, and I'm lit up with an inner mission now. But that mission is not that crazy ambitious kind of mission, but an inner vision, if I may say so, of greater abundance, greater peace, and greater well-being for all. And that is what drives me to do what I do. And because I have been teaching for over a decade now at my wisdom school in California and through our YouTube and other channels worldwide, what I've noticed is, and from the emails and the reports and the talking to the various people who are now beginning to, you know, adventure with these sciences in their own personal arenas of their life, I'm noticing improved marriages, better parenting, radically improved physical health, better sleep, better mental coping, less breakdown. People are surprising themselves that instead of feeling jealous, which was their default response, they feel more compassionate or happy for the person who is, you know, doing well, thinking, oh, they must be doing something wonderful, or they must have put in some good karma there. Way to go. This is great. This universe rewards us when we begin to reward, when we behave in a manner that is in alignment with universe and our greater self. So it's been a joyful ride looking at the explosion of people, individuals, families, you know, improve in their well-being. And then we run so many free of cost community courses. I have graduates who are teaching in the prisons of California. There's everywhere we are noticing that the human being is deeply humbled when they come across this wisdom and they accept it, no matter which culture they came from, because it's universal. It's not just meant for Indians or or Hindus or vegetarians. It's meant for everybody. And it's been great to be a humble part of this. And I'm a lifelong student. I'm not perfect. I'm just growing with it and mm-hmm. feeling blessed by it.
When you began this work, and this is going to sound maybe a little like a strange question, but why did you care? I mean, you could have taken this and just gone off into your cave somewhere and just thrived yourself, you know, instead of having to deal with the minutia of stuff that's out there in the world of people, just kind of said, you know, I'm just going to do this stuff myself. You know, I don't have the time to deal with the trauma of the rest of the world kind of thing. What propelled you forward?
Once again, the greater wisdom, I'll just turn to that for, it gave me greater insights into who I am. And it explains four types of personality. One personality type is, a spiritual scholar, meditator, and they do like to live in the cave and just be in that bliss and radiate that, you know. There's the other kind, which is a spiritual warrior, and they take up causes. And, you know, they'd like to make a difference and they like to bring about greater protection and welfare. And they're hardwired to do that. There is a third kind that takes anything, even spiritual knowledge, and converts into commerce. And it's not a bad thing. Commerce is not a bad word. Commerce is necessary because if it was not for these people, we couldn't even buy a yoga mat or a singing bowl. You know, we need those people. And then there is the fourth kind who don't have an impulse to necessarily do any of the above, but they do like to support or help or make themselves useful and generally have a normal life. And, we all belong in those categories because not everybody can be a leader. We also need helpers and supporters. And that's the fourth kind. And I find that I am a mix of the top two. I cannot do any commerce. I don't sell anything, not because I'm so great, but because I cannot, you know. Mm-hmm. So what I do is I realize I'm a scholar. So I, spend a bulk of my time reading, meditating, journaling, writing. But then I'm also cause driven and I've always stood up for whatever is unfair or what could be fixed. So I head associations, I create organizations, and I'm recently been appointed as an advisor to the government of India on Ayurveda and yoga matters. And I know that if I'm not there, I'm not living in alignment with my higher self that wants to make a difference. And because I recognize these both aspects of myself, I live in integration of them and not trying to fight either one of them. I'm a bit more of I'm a bit of a recluse. So I literally leave my home four times a month, maybe literally. And my husband does the grocery shopping and I spend a lot of time in my garden with my dogs and with my books. But then on my phone or my email, my impact is big because it's part of different causes, which is really the cause of the Vedic wisdom and my wanting elitist, authentic.
Okay, I can't hear you now. Something changed.
Can you hear me now, Richard?
Yes.
So I want a non-commercialized, non-elitist, authentic Ayurveda wisdom along with yoga and Vedanta to reach the world. So you'll see me active at least till age 65.
Well, I'm just a scant 57 years on this planet, and I have reached a certain level of my attitude is, you know, my dad is 86. Okay, so he's lived a lot longer than I, and you'd think he'd be even more frustrated than I. And actually, the word isn't so much frustration; it's more along the lines of what we do with this program. It's like I'm tired of living this survival mode, producer consumer concept, this whole thing. And again, that's totally different from the commerce thing that you're talking about. I want for others to be able to pursue their dreams, to pursue their life's purpose, to follow that inner guidance and not the outer screamings of family and job. And it's like I was saying before, people don't take vacations because they're afraid they're going to lose their job. And I have to tell you that there was a certain element of push that I had to do in order to get that week and yet still having to stay connected to the work that I do, even though I was on vacation. But it was enough of a disconnect that, boy, we just, I hated for it to come to an end. At the same time, I was glad to, of course, get home and still have a few days to relax before going back to work. One of the elements also I wanted to ask you about, and you actually alluded to that in your description. My wife and I built this small little 4x8 foot above ground, we'll call it a greenhouse, that's covered with screening. It's got three walls, and then we've planted several different things in it. And that's just the first of many of these things that we're going to put together. And I remember when she planted the seeds, and it was only a few days after she had planted them, she was frustrated because she didn't even see little sprouts. And I said, "You have to be patient. They're coming. They're coming. Just relax." And they are just going nuts. And it's only been a few weeks, well, maybe a couple of months. But it's, and then of course we were gone for 10 days, but we were able to go back up and get a few things during the fire. And so I made it a point that I would water this little garden. But even when they were just starting to come up, I was really talking to them. And so for some that may sound very strange, but I wanted to encourage them to grow, that, man, we're just so excited that we have this, because I remember what it's like to be asked while my wife was cooking, "Hey, could you go out to the garden and pick a squash? Because I need it for the recipe." Sure. So I go out there and I pick one and bring it in, and she cuts it up and puts it in there. And I mean, you talk about live food. And I look forward to that experience again with this new garden. But this is part of the Ayurvedic lifestyle. Talk to us about the use of flowers and vegetable gardens and all of this aspect of growing things. Maybe that's the element of it that nourishes and nurtures us.
I mean, yeah, I mean, you noticed it, you know, putting your hands in the soil, being out there in the garden, tending to a living being, seeing the miracle of life grow, and then, you know, and then having a relationship with it, and then consuming it with, you know, deep reverence and gratefulness instead of just mindlessly spending money. And, you know, and so there, I bet when you grow your homegrown zucchinis, you have so much, you know, you don't want to waste it. You want to be so careful, you know, and what do you need and how much you consume and slowing down to taste it and all of that. So that makes a difference. But definitely, I have a whole series of classes I've taught on garden herbs, which is available on my website. But I want to say that I taught that series, more importantly, and again, I'm not sure if it's on my website, so people will have to check. But I taught that series because I protest against the kind of Ayurveda that the rest of the world or a large proportion of the world likes to promote, which is, you know, buying nutraceuticals in bottles and nobody cares where those herbs were. And probably they were, you know, they were harvested from the wild in the Himalayas or the Mount Everest foothills without any permission. And, you know, and often these herbs take years to grow, and, you know, they grow in a certain climate, and worldwide there is this procurement for, you know, herbs now that Ayurveda is getting famous and popular. And I'm sad to tell you that 90% of Ayurveda herbs in India are now on the endangered list just within the last two decades.
Oh my.
Because the worldwide demand for Ayurveda herbs, and also since neem and turmeric, all of them became popular. And so, especially by American pharmaceutical companies, there's a worldwide rush to patent these Ayurveda medicines. So, but given all of that, it became very important for me to not buy herbs, but to actually grow your own medicine. And that becomes part of the mindfulness journey back to your own healing. So something as simple as marigold, you know, which are like in the season during summer, you know, they bloom throughout the summer and then they give these beautiful seeds that then regrow again. You know, marigold is a huge medicine. You can just crush its leaves or its petals and apply it on your skin, and it's going to calm down blemishes or even, you know, remove your problem for acne and pimples forever. You know, or if you drink its tea, dried marigolds or fresh, It actually helps with weight loss and cholesterol, and even reduces the excessive heat and perspiration that some of us can feel. So this is an example. Another example is the roses. The rose is the most common and favorite flower in all of America, United States, and the rest of the world, actually. And the rose flower, it balances all our energies and helps the mind. So, you know, we take rose petals and mix it with hot water, some cardamom seeds for flavor, and some sugar, and we make our own syrup, and we drink that instead of soda or juices. And what we might notice is that acid problem goes away, flatulence reduces, anxiety calms down. So there is just an end list of things. And then, again, the question can be, how do we know? How do we believe that? Well, for thousands of years, this has been medicine. And then, you know, I was a skeptic person myself, so I didn't write a book. I wrote my book after 3 decades of working with it and noticing for myself that a simple rose sherbet, homemade rose sherbet remedy could actually be great anti-anxiety agent rather than having to take an anti-anxiety pill with side effects. And so once I had confirmed all my learning in the laboratory of real people right here in United States, California, I'm here talking on the radio show. And the best part is you grow your own roses. So you don't put pesticides. You put natural, you know, compost in it, and you grow them. And they love us. When we nurture them, they know us, and then they are happy to gift us healing when we consume them after praying to them and thanking them.
Acharya Shunya is my guest, and we're talking about the Ayurvedic lifestyle, and her latest work is the Ayurvedic Lifestyle Wisdom Book, which I encourage you to get a copy of. I happen to have a copy, grateful that that I do, and I go through it from time to time, and it's information. It's not just information, it's wisdom. It's something that is going to help us to find, as we talk on this program, those new ways of living, and this is one of them. And it's what's funny is it's not new; it's old. It's ancient, and yet it's timeless. It may be ancient, but it is timeless. And yet some of the things that I hear sometimes that I used to hear on the news, Acharya, about this concept called exporting democracy. And I've seen the direction that our country has gone at large, and I'm going, please, God, don't. Let them find their own way. If they want it, fine. But let them find their own way. They have a right to self-determination, you know. If I may quote a science fiction line of self-determination and so forth, the prime directive, you know, of non-interference. If they want the help, I'm more than glad to give it. And I sometimes wonder about that as well, even on an individual level. Growing up in this business, I first started working in a Christian radio station, and greatest education I was ever paid for, and learned a lot about, other than just broadcasting, so many other subjects. And asking questions that most of these people did not want to answer, because they would have to, it would challenge them to have to deal with the subject too. But I always found that it was frustrating for me to hear that I could eat, drink a myriad of different things. I could pursue any educational direction that I wanted. I could do any kind of job or work that I wanted to do, have any kind of family or no family, et cetera, et cetera. But when it came to spirituality, there was only one way. And I'm going, that doesn't make any sense. Every other element of my human existence has a multiplicity of choices that I can make, but my spirituality only has one? And so I began my search at the age of 17, 40 years ago. And it's been great. The things that I've learned, the people that I have met, including yourself, Acharya Shunya, who is our guest here on the program. Can you share with us a little bit more about your process, your search? I mean, you grew up in this philosophy, if you will, but and I'm wondering, did that make it any easier?
No, I think it made it tougher.
Really?
Easier in the long run, of course. What a gift. But when you're a child and you are born in a family that is quite set in its ways, and I was not a child who follows easily, so it's both a good and a bad thing. I tend to want to question everything. And I think ultimately that's a good thing. So I questioned what I was born in. So I didn't come into it, in my late 20s or early 30s or late 40s, kind of already reading books and wanting to explore. I just opened my eyes to it. And India was going through a lot of changes at that time. It was modernizing, and Ayurveda was becoming more of the ancient medicine at that time. So in the beginning, I had to go through a process of, as a teenager, I rejected many aspects of the traditional system of, remaining healthy and what are the deeper value systems. But when I look at it retrospectively, Richard, I think it was all good because during that time, I became very emotionally, and physically challenged because I had a lot of pain in my body. And much later, I found out that I have a genetic condition, an aberration, because of which my immune system wants to attack me. People with my so-called condition live in wheelchairs, have multiple surgeries, or live on opiates and all kinds of things, or even marijuana to deal with the pain. But so when my pain increased, my grandfather, who's my teacher, who I call Baba, came back to me and, very gently said, "Would you like to try Ayurveda again?" And it was just a few years that I was like, "No, I'm just going to live the way I want to live, the modern being, And I said, "Yeah," because I had no other choices. And Ayurveda became my personal miracle. And I'm 50, and I run, and I walk, and I don't plan to be in a wheelchair. And occasionally, if my pain comes back, I know exactly what I have to do, what I have to eat, what oil I have to apply. And then I can talk about it on the public forum. So my disease has become my friend. And the initial difficulties of kind of living up to a grand lineage has become a way of life for me now. And the lineage, it sounds really huge and heavy, especially in the modern world, to have ancestors who go back thousands of years. But now it's like, well, they were just human beings like me who must have ultimately dedicated their life to something that must have given them personal value. A lineage is not an imprisoned, forced wisdom tradition, but it's people coming into it and vying by its benefits because it became an intimate revelation to them that nature is the teacher. And yes, that's my journey. And so I do live with a so-called condition. I have a genetic test to prove it. And I do have an occasional twitch here or there, or for a while there, I showed my students that I couldn't lift my left arm. And then I said, "And give me a few weeks and I'll lift my arm." And then showed them how my arm was being lifted all the way up. So it's like, it's fun. It's my own challenge. And it's been my own personal journey with this knowledge. And probably that's one of the reasons I have so much conviction, and that because it saved me my own life.
Yeah. Well, I've been doing a number of interviews over the years in regard to sound, for example, and music, and then even our own individual music that we make. And one of the interesting elements that I often share has to do with the healing power of vibration. And in my case, with my example, when I was a kid, I was suffering with, I think it was the flu, something, and I was laying there in bed and I was moaning, 'cause it was uncomfortable, and that's what I was doing. And my sister and my mother were standing over me, and I remember them, my sister saying to my mother, "Make him stop. He sounds terrible." To which my mother said, "No, that's how he heals himself." And I never thought about it per se. It's just what I did. And so I encourage anybody who's not feeling really good, who's feeling that way, whatever the note is, whatever the vibration is, go ahead and do it. Because if it helps and it makes you feel better, so then I start getting into these programs about this whole aspect of vibration and different tones and so forth. And I think we'll make this the last part of this particular interview. Talk to me a little bit, if you can, does the Ayurvedic lifestyle talk about this aspect of sound and vibration in the process of health and well-being?
Absolutely. I mean, this is such a profound discovery. In fact, the entire Ayurveda texts were written in the form of poetry, sing-song. Mm. And there is a whole discussion around how music can actually change the vibrations from which I had begun our discussion on agitating vibration or dullness and depression vibration to harmonious, balancing, intelligent vibration. And music is the first way to do it. Mm-hmm. So I'm not a great musician myself, but I've been exploring drumming and playing the, you know, musical balls and, you know, and the singing balls. And, you know, it's just been beautiful. I do it for myself. I would never do it in public because it's not what I do. But for my own self, I do it, and we recommend, music therapy and instruments and engaging with sounds, chanting, mantras, all of this on a very routine basis, Richard. And I'm so glad you brought it up. I feel like the divine sings to us through these instruments.
Well, I remember the great opportunity that I had to interview my parents, who are still alive, by the way. And in the context of that interview, I asked them about the importance from their perspective of music. And of course, they, you know, when we would travel, we would sing songs as we traveled along. When at Christmas time, the family would get together and we would carol through the neighborhood to different houses. Sometimes we even sang to empty houses. So it was practice. But it was very important to them. And it, even to this day, they say it's still very important to them. So, I encourage people to find that music that resonates with them. And man, there is so much out there. It's just, how can you not find that which you like that helps you along? And it's going to change from time to time, depending upon where you're at, both physically, mentally, and emotionally. I want to thank you so much, Acharya, for joining us here on the program. This has been wonderful. I just can't thank you enough. And I just wanted to also ask you, I've got a couple of questions, three questions that I ask everyone, and I may have asked these of you, but there may be people who are listening who have never heard your interview before. So if you will bear with me, you may have even addressed these answers in the context of this interview. But first of all, again, thank you. And if you ever find yourself down here in Santa Barbara, we'd love to have you in studio to continue our conversation.
Thank you. I would take up that opportunity in future.
First question is, who is Acharya Shunya?
A divine being having a wonderful earthly experience and making the best of it.
And what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
I wish to give everyone the same hope that has rejuvenated me, the hope of wisdom that has come from old, old beings who wanted peace and welfare for all. I want to share the good news.
Mm. And finally, what is your life's purpose?
To know my true self and to know God. That alone is my life purpose. Mm.
Again, I thank you so much for joining us on the program. It's just been a great pleasure, and I do look forward to our next interview.
Thank you, Richard.
I'm Richard Dugan, and we've been talking with Acharya Shunya. Again, the website, acharyashunya.com, acharyashunya.com. And there is also Vedika Global, and there's a link on her website. And we're going to link to these sites as well on richarddugan.com at the radio show's page as well. So you'll be able to go there and read more about her, read more about the work that she is doing, and maybe study with her and connect with her and find that wonderful Ayurvedic lifestyle and the aspects that work for you. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love Talal.